court is ready to hear argument in 040181 and raise the Susan Cortez.
The jury system does not work if parties cannot depend on the removal of a veneer member who has admitted bias in open court.
Can you help me just with the preliminary matter?
Sure. Let me back up. This is a nursing home case. It was tried to a jury in San Antonio several years ago.
Counsel, the court is, I think, well familiar with the case.
I think you're probably were attempting to anticipate where I'm going. I thought you won.
We won against the settling defendant, against the non-settling defendant, HCCI, Inc. We barely won. We got a judgment of $50,000, which is, given the facts of the case, we view as...
Does it matter if you won or didn't win in this case? Does it matter if you actually won or didn't win in this case
in
this particular issue?
In terms of whether or not there was error in jury selection, I don't think that it matters.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to imply that it did. I just was confused because that didn't come across to me as... Never mind.
Okay.
if we hadn't had this juror number 7 on, you'd have gotten a lot more, is your theory.
I honestly think that we had to seat a juror who was against us, who worked for an insurance carrier.
To explain, by the way, just briefly, why that's a requirement of law. You just said you didn't like number 7, but didn't have to state any reason. Don't state none in the record of why you didn't like 7.
My understanding of, in terms of preserving error, is that what we need to do is prior to...
Is pick a number that's on the jury and say we would have struck him or her.
That's right.
Without saying any reason.
That's right.
So, frankly, you could pick any number.
I think you could pick any number. I mean, we picked an honest number.
There doesn't have to be anything in the record suggesting why that person might have been against you.
My understanding of the case law and the Halleck case...
I know that's the case law. I just can't figure out why we would ask you to pick a number. Don't tell us why. Just tell us, well, I would have struck somebody else. Obviously, you would have struck somebody else. That's why you...
Well, yes, Your Honor, and you're correct. The rule could be different, and the parties could be required to state a reason, like in a Batson challenge. If there's a question about why a party is striking a jury, if it's based on race, then they might have to name a neutral reason.
Tell me on why is it wrong to rehabilitate a juror in the sense of they say. Make it as extreme as you want. I'm going to vote against the plaintiff. Why is it wrong to ask the next question, why? Why should we prohibit a judge or the attorneys for either side asking why?
I guess I can answer that with a rhetorical question. Would anyone here want a juror on their panel who says, I'm biased and I can be fair? And
what if the jury says, Mr. Fred Hornbuckle's one of their attorneys, and you say, I'm not Fred Hornbuckle, that's somebody else. I'm Steve Hornbuckle. And the juror then says, oh, my mistake, never mind.
That's a fair hypothetical. I don't think it fits the facts of this case.
Your position is once they say bias, that's end. The judge must stop. There is no further questioning. Why would we want to do that? The juror might be mistaken.
You can imagine a hypothetical where it was an honest mistake. But what you have here and what would happen if you didn't have the rule that prohibited rehabilitation is you get a juror before getting up in front of a very intimidating court and being questioned by the court, a figure of authority in a robe, in a very frightening situation for a layperson. They would confess bias, and I think that the initial admission of bias would be the more honest statement. Then, if you're allowed to rehabilitate, you would go back and the court could say, or other lawyers, and you could bully the juror into saying, well, you can be fair, can't you? And everybody wants to say
why
they
then
can be
don't
fair.
We, so that's arguing we should have a rule against bullying, but
well,
not rehabilitation.
It's not necessarily bullying, but when the a figure of authority, the court, and that was the case in this instance, asked questions like, well, you can listen to the evidence, can't you? And you can be fair. There's a natural inclination to say, oh, yes, I can, Judge. Yes, I can.
Well, why shouldn't the trial court be given some discretion and latitude in making that determination as to whether a potential juror can render a true and true verdict?
I think that there is discretion, but I think that there is bias as a matter of law also. In some cases, not this one, but in some cases there may be some ambiguity with respect to whether or not there's been a clear expression of bias, and that is discretion. But this is straight out of Shepherd v. Ledford. Yeah,
an artful trial lawyer can have any veneerment struck for cause by leading the questions and getting potential juror to answer those questions of bias affirmatively every time.
I apologize, Your Honor. Trick left ear. No.
It's okay. I'm not going to repeat it. Go ahead.
Let me ask you. I understand the line of authority that, you know, once the bias word's out there, can be no rehabilitation. But don't you have to look at context? I mean, it strikes me what happened here is when you look at everything this juror said, he pretty much said, I'm an insurance adjuster, and I see a lot of frivolous lawsuits in my job, and I am biased against frivolous lawsuits. Well, I mean, everybody's biased against frivolous lawsuits. He also acknowledged that he sees good claims, too. So if you look at it in context, don't you think that the bias he expressed was as to lawsuit abuse?
I really don't think so. He says that basically, and I mean, it's nothing against their case, but we see so many of those. It's not this type
many
of case.
Many of those.
So many
of
cases.
Those. No.
He doesn't really use the phrase frivolous lawsuits.
He was referring to lawsuit abuse.
I don't think he ever used the phrase lawsuit
yes,
abuse.
It's there. I mean, he talks about tort reform and I thought he said lawsuit abuse. If not lawsuit abuse, frivolous lawsuits. And that's what bothered me is we're looking at that one phrase out of context, but he seems to be talking about we see a lot of that abuse in the system. So why can't we look at the context of the statement?
I think that once he
clearly expresses, I don't really know how to say it, but lawsuit abuse, we see it so many times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to say those cases.
Well, that's the reason that he's biased. That's the reason that the plaintiff is starting out.
But isn't everyone biased against lawsuit abuse? I would.
Everyone has an opinion about whether or not there is lawsuit abuse, but that doesn't make every juror biased. If the juror says, well, I'm concerned about lawsuit abuse, I don't think that disqualifies them. But then if you follow up and ask, well, do your concerns about lawsuit abuse, make it such that one party is starting out before another party before
but,
you
okay,
even get
let
into
me
the
ask
jury
you about that. Because when you start out, mm-hmm. the plaintiff always starts out behind because they've got the burden of proof. So to say one party, here's a panel, this is a car wreck case, I'm trying to recover money, does anybody think I start out behind? Well, yes, you do, because you've got to meet your burden of proof. What's incorrect about, I mean, to say I'm a little bit behind, isn't that an accurate statement of the law?
Well, I don't think he says he doesn't say how far we are behind. The burden of proof, I think each side start out evenly, and the plaintiff has the burden to tip the scales more likely than not.
Or they lose. So they start out behind if they're even.
Well, I think they start out. I think you could characterize it such that you start out evenly, and the plaintiff has the burden to get a little ahead. I don't think that the plaintiff starts out at the end zone and has to run all the way up to the 50-yard line and then cross it. I think you start out even. Scales of justice, and the plaintiff has to put the scales there in order to meet their burden of proof. So I don't think that they do start out behind, and I've never heard it phrased that way in describing the burden of proof. And in trial court, it's always been expressed such that the scales of justice, and you have to tip the scales of justice your way.
The other side said you can distinguish our prior cases. Do you agree with that? You're about to mention Shook and maybe others.
I really disagree that this case is distinguishable. And I think if you look at the questions that were asked to the juror that was disqualified as a matter of law, that juror was asked an almost identical question to the to one of the questions that his claims manager was asked. The question, this is on Shepherd v. Ledford, page 34, as a question, as a result of that, you feel that Mrs. Ledford would be, you would feel for her and put her ahead of the defense in this case. Answer, I think so. Like I said, my dad was after that for a long, he was in a coma, so I seen him suffer a lot, and I know what it did to me. Under that circumstance.
As a result of what? You started off as a result of.
There's a prior question to, is there anybody else after we've listened to this? There was a series of questions in this case, and the first two, the questions were whether or not they could objectively consider the evidence in a neutral way, and two jurors said, I don't think so.
Let me put the question in context. Jurors walk into a courtroom. They don't even know if it's a civil or criminal case. You ask them, how many of them you stand up first, and how many of you think I'm starting behind? Obviously, no one raises their hand. There's no basis to do so.
Right.
Now you tell them it's a suit against a nursing home for negligence. Anybody think I'm starting about behind or ahead because I'm suing a nursing home? Two people say you're starting out behind, and 12 people say you're starting out ahead because everybody hates nursing homes. Can we strike all the people for cause that say they hate nursing homes and therefore you're starting out a little ahead?
If you follow up and ask them, does your hatred of...
So the answer is no at that point.
If someone just says, I hate nursing homes...
Say, but I really don't like nursing homes, so you're starting out a little ahead.
I think that would disqualify.
Disqualify everybody. So we only have a jury made up of people who have no feeling or knowledge of nursing homes. Is that reflective of the community?
They have knowledge of nursing homes, and I know from experience that you do have a problem with jurors disqualifying themselves because they dislike nursing homes, and that comes out in every trial, and it's especially important to the defense to be able to get jurors out.
Let's go a step further. You've told the jury, as you did in this case, our case has to do, our client was blind, left alone in a bathroom, broke her hip, and as a result later died. How many of you think Mr. Hornbuckle is starting out a little ahead? Now many people raise their hands. Aren't they doing that because, based on the facts you've told them? And aren't we, therefore, if we disqualify them, we're striking them for telling us how they think they're going to vote based on the facts of the case?
I don't think that it's the way that they're going to vote. It's a question about, given the facts of the case, is one party starting out ahead of another?
What's the difference? What's the difference in the following two questions? If you had to vote now, who would you vote for? And the question, am I starting, based on what you've heard, am I starting out a little ahead or behind? I can't think of any difference in those questions at all. Can you? You obviously couldn't ask them based on what you've heard so far, are you going to vote for me or them? That would be improper.
I've never heard it asked. I've never heard that question asked.
Because everybody knows that would be improper. My question, is there any difference in this question and that one?
I think with asking them how you're going to vote, you're asking for a commitment.
When you're asking them in this context, after telling them some of the facts, am I starting a little behind? Aren't you asking for a commitment as well?
I don't think so. You're just asking them where they, whether or not they're prior experiences or what they bring with them into the courtroom causes one party or the other to start out behind. So I think it has to be in the context of prior experience. Is there something that you brought into you with this courtroom today that causes one party or the other to start out ahead or behind?
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions? Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Thank you, Court. Ms. Lawyer Proctor will present argument for the respondent.
Please, Court. Good morning. I first want to correct one thing about the factual background that you asked. What actually happened was a judgment, joint several judgment in favor of the plaintiff was awarded against all three defendants for $1 million in actual compensatory damages. Then the jury went on and awarded punitive damages against the two defendants who are not being appealed here for a total of $8,250,000. So the entire judgment was $9,250,000, and it is only the $50,000 portion that ended up being judgment against my client.
So is your position if there was error, then would it be harmless error?
Absolutely. It is my position that it would be harmless error. It's also my position that if we start allowing parties to pick and choose, in this case specifically, they're saying that they were forced to try the case in front of a jury that contained a member that was an objectionable to them and should have been stricken, or a member should have been stricken so that that juror could also have been stricken.
Once they've stated that they have a biased or prejudiced against one side or the other, why shouldn't they be struck as a matter of law?
If, in fact, this juror had, or potential juror, had said to the judge, I cannot be fair and impartial, as has been stated in the cases where that's been upheld, then I would agree. But this juror never got to that point. He was consistently equivocal. Every time a question was asked him, he would say things like, I can't be sure, I don't know, it might.
From reading the record,
could almost go either way.
Reading the record appears to me that he was evasive. So shouldn't the trial court be given some discretion?
Absolutely, and that's exactly why. And that's one of our primary points on that issue. Assuming that the Hallett notice was properly and timely given, which we dispute, then all of the case law is consistent in saying that the trial court judge has to be given broad latitude and discretion in determining whether a potential juror person has actually expressed bias or prejudice. You've all seen jurors who stand at the bench asking or answering the questions being posed them either by the court or by the attorneys, and they've got their head down and they're shifting their feet and they're nodding their head and they're shaking their head. All of those things are observations that the court makes in determining at that point.
But even if we're not there, you can see that on certain records it would be clear enough a judge was bullying a juror into saying, sure, I can put it all aside.
Absolutely.
That we could say as a matter of law they should have been stricken.
Absolutely. Not this case, but that absolutely has happened. In fact, in the cases where it was decided in favor of the petitioner that the case should be remanded for trial because the juror has expressed bias. I think it's clear in the Shepherd case when the juror said, I feel just like the panel member who was stricken for cause. I feel just like that panel member does. I think that's clear. Obviously, if the court's going to strike two panel members because they have expressed a clear bias and then not strike a third who says he feels the same way, obviously, that's a record that the court can look at and determine clear bias.
Was there in this case properly preserved?
No. For a couple of reasons. Number one, all of the case law is consistent that the Hallett notice must be given prior to the time that peremptory challenges are exercised. Case law also establishes that peremptory challenges are exercised once the list is delivered to the court.
Which normally doesn't appear in our record.
Correct. Which is why we then have to go to the rule that says that it is the petitioner's burden to prove in the record that they are timely making their Hallett notice. Even when the trial judge says that's preserved.
Generally, if a trial judge makes that comment, it's been my experience, the litigants stand down and move on. Do they need to urge the judge to allow them to make a proper record?
Well, in this case, it would have been impossible because they did not timely make their Howlett notice. If they had set it, it is incumbent upon the litigants to preserve the error. And in this case, what should have been done is, A, prior to making the peremptory challenges and delivering them to the court, they should have brought it to the court's attention that they were going to have to, in the future, use a peremptory strike on an objectionable juror that would allow another objectionable juror to remain on the panel. In this case, it just like in the directed verdict, when the litigant says, comes now the defendant, after the close of the plaintiff's case and prior to the commencement of defense's evidence, we make this directed verdict motion. In this case, in order to preserve your Howlett notice was timely made, when you are making it, you say, comes now the plaintiff. And before exercising his peremptory strikes, advises the court that he will be forced to strike an objectionable juror that was not properly stricken for cause, and that will cause an objectionable juror to remain on the panel. That was not done in this case. The record has no reflection that the Howlett challenge was timely made. In addition, the record actually implies that the challenge was not made timely, because when the attorney does make the objection, he speaks in the past tense of, I had to exercise a strike on Mr. Snyder, and so we had to allow juror number 7 to remain on the panel. What is also interesting and distinguishable in the case is that in the Howlett and the Shepherd cases, the panel ended up with a juror who the court did not strike after motion by one of the litigants. In this case, it's different. The juror that they wanted stricken for cause, they used a peremptory challenge on, and he did not end up on the jury. I say that because I think it's distinguishable, because in those two cases, it was obvious that the juror was objectionable because a strike motion had already been made by the party. In this case, there was never a motion to strike juror number 7 for cause, and therefore, there is no record that that juror was objectionable. The case law states that in order to appropriately preserve your Howlett challenge, you must state a specific juror, which was admittedly done in this case, number 7 would remain on the panel, or did remain on the panel in the past tense, but the fact that the juror was objectionable was never even stated. Any basis for the objection.
Which of our cases says you have to give a reason why the juror is objecting?
No prior case does, although it is somewhat implied in the Howlett case, because the petitioner's argument was, we don't have to re-raise this issue. We already asked that the juror be struck for cause, and to reiterate it would be silly. But the court found, no, in fact, it's not. In order to avoid just the situation that we're in here, you must give the trial court an opportunity to correct the error. You must tell the trial court, I've exhausted all my peremptory challenges, and this juror remains who is objectionable. Now, I think that the trial court is aware of the reason for the objection of the juror if a challenge for cause has been made. But if one has not been made, and there is no case law either way on this, then the party should have to go further and explain why that juror is objectionable, or otherwise, like you said, Judge Brister, we end up having appeals on cases where, you know, numbers, how do we know number 7 was objectionable? How do we know we're not wasting our time here and haven't been doing
that? Well, objectionable is not equivalent to being able to strike for cause.
True.
Both your challenges are not designed for that.
I agree. But I don't think any case ever gets tried where one party doesn't have somebody after exercising peremptory challenges who they think is objectionable.
But isn't it true? I mean, just like in that scenario, area, you'll just get people coming up with, you know, shuffling feet reasons, or, you know, really they just lie or just present anything to explain. I mean, why should we make them state why they're exercising a peremptory strike? It just seems like it's failed in the federal system.
the reason that one should be required to do that at that level is solely in the Hallett notice situation, so that the use of the Hallett challenge is not abused. There should be some basis, and so that harm can be determined.
In the criminal context, when you say who you're having to take, you're also supposed to ask the judge for an additional peremptory strike, which suppose, or initial peremptory or strike for cause, which I suppose a judge could do in a civil case as well. And so it puts the judge on notice of who's bad that you're taking, so the judge can decide, was this person also a questionable person or not? Where if it's just somebody out of the blue, there's no basis for the trial judge to do that, is there?
Exactly.
Get to the question, if you would, the starting ahead and behind. Proper question or not?
You know, and I hadn't really considered it, although it always pains me when the question's asked, because generally,
you all ask the question too.
We do. And
everybody asks this question.
You're exactly right.
Why is it any different from asking everybody how they're going to vote?
And it's not. And I think you're exactly correct. I think it is an incorrect question, and I certainly don't think it's a question that.
And what are y'all all going to say if a question everybody asks we say suddenly is improper?
Oops. you've all heard it in the voir dire examinations that is asked. And a lot of times, as I do in mine, if they answer it, then I tell them, hey, you know what, you haven't heard any evidence, you really can't say blah, 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 follow it up that way. But have used it more as a guide, not as something that I would use to disqualify a jury. And I disagree with Mr. Hornbuckle that if 12 of the panelists say that they hate nursing homes, I don't think that's enough to get them off. I'd sure like for that to be the case, but I don't think that's enough to strike them
off. If they say they hate nursing homes, that's not enough to get them off, as opposed to don't like them, they've got a bad reputation,
without any follow-up, I do not think that's enough to strike them for cause.
Let me distinguish between an attorney asking the question, how many of you hate nursing homes, and having someone raise their hand, which I think can qualitatively, depending on the circumstance, be different from a juror just stating voluntarily, I hate nursing homes.
Correct.
If they truly believe that, you think, without more, that's not enough for them to get off the panel.
If they volunteer that without being asked by counsel, then I think that may be on its face enough. That is a general question to the panel. You know, how many of you have strong feelings? How many of you hate nursing homes? I ask it, but I don't get all those people stricken with their hands.
Well, if they say we're leaning against nursing homes, then you said you use that as a signal to delve into it further with them.
Correct.
And then maybe you may find a bias that is sufficient to strike them for cause.
That's correct.
But a lean doesn't get you there.
I don't think so. It would be like in a criminal case. How many of you hate murderers? Everybody raises your hand. Okay, well, we can't get a fair jury here because this guy's on trial for murder. There has to be, and it's the same thing on the other side. How many of you hate lawsuit abuse? How many of you hate frivolous lawsuits? Well, if they're trying a frivolous lawsuit, then yeah, they ought to be concerned. But if they're not, then the bias against murderers or frivolous lawsuits is not what should be considered.
Some of your questions beg the ultimate question. If you say how many hate murderers, well, that's what they're there to decide. The question is how many hate nursing homes. That's a fact. That's not subject to proof over evidence at trial.
Well, I guess it's from my defensive perspective, it is yet to be proven if we are a hated nursing home.
When does a trial judge's discretion stop when a trial judge is trying to impanel a jury?
Well, I think that it stops when the juror absolutely states the magic words, which this potential juror never did.
But an artful attorney on either side can get, it's been my experience, potential juror to say the magic words by leading him or her down that path to bias or prejudice.
And I thought that was a little questionable in the Shepherd case. again, I think if the juror, potential juror, says, this is just not a case I can be fair in, I have opinions about this and I can't be fair, and I've had them do that very adamantly, is different than a juror saying, you know, I don't know if this is going to affect me or not, and then the attorney saying, so are you saying that in this case you cannot be fair and impartial and that my client starts behind as we sit here right now? And the juror saying, yeah. All observations that the court is making at the time.
Isn't the problem in that and the rehab question the use of leading questions?
Yes, absolutely.
So the problem is we're asking leading questions, stuffing words into their mouths that then they say, well, maybe yes or no.
Exactly. I don't think this juror ever would have said preconceived notions. And what is really important with respect to the court's discretion is that Judge Littlejohn was asking the questions, and she was being very open-ended. Tell me why you feel that. I don't understand why you feel, I don't really understand what you're saying.
Normally we allow leading questions when it's the opposite side, but not when it's your own side. Which one are jurors?
Neither. The challenge, again, I just want to make sure that I'm clear. It is the petitioner's burden to preserve that and to provide you guys with a record that indicates that it was properly and timely preserved, and that was not done here. It would have been very easy to do had, in fact, it been done timely, but it was not. I think the record reflects it was not by the counsel's use of past tense word and by the rapidity with which the jury was then seated immediately after that challenge was made.
Now, was the jury seated before the objection was made, or was the objection made as the lawyer for the defender seats to be?
The record doesn't reflect it, but the peremptory challenges had already been handed over. There was some shuffling in the courtroom. Then the objection was made.
Why should it matter if the rest of the panel members are still out there and the judge can make a decision to remove one of the jury members? You still have a selection of jurors out there. Why can't they do that?
Because it's too late then, because the case law says that your appointments have been made once they've been delivered. It is now out of the court's hand to strike a jury without returning the peremptory challenge list, giving us more time to go back and make the challenges based on the fact we now know this other juror has been struck.
Are we missing items from the record that would answer these questions, or?
No, I think the only way that it could be answered is an affirmative statement by someone on the record without challenge.
Well, we know the jury wasn't seated because after the Mr. Rhodes' motion to strike number 15, the court tells everybody to gather around the back of the courtroom and then call out the names of the 12 jurors. So the 12 jurors had not been placed at the box.
No, that's undisputed. They had not.
There was still time to substitute somebody. Of course, you can, under Batson, you can substitute somebody even after they're in the box.
True. But the case law with respect to Hallett and with respect to making your peremptory challenges indicates once they're delivered, they're made. And so,
but the judge still could, if the judge was convinced that number 7 was bad too, the judge could have struck 7, allowed both sides an additional peremptory, and we still could have fixed the problem.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please report. There are several things that I'd like to set the record straight on. Mr. Tristan, I think Ms. Proctor mentioned that he was not a party to this appeal. I believe that's incorrect, and I didn't mean to misstate the in answer to your question, Justice O'Neill, that I did not mean to misstate that we didn't get a judgment against Mr. Tristan for punitive damages. We did, $250. I just think that it's uncollectible. That's why I didn't include it. I certainly wasn't meaning to mislead anybody. It's certainly judgment proof.
So if this goes back for a new trial, you will have collected over $1 million, and the settling defendant will no longer be in the courtroom, and the trial will go back just as to this one
as to HCCI and Mr. Tristan, we will have paid $950. $950 was the settlement with the settling party, Ultimate Nursing, Inc.
Are there no circumstances under which we should ever look at the verdict in deciding if there's harmful error in a challenge for cause?
I think that the harm occurs when an improper juror is seated or an objectionable juror is seated or the parties have to use a strike on an objectionable juror.
But we know, how did juror number 7 vote? With everybody else?
I think juror number 7 was with the majority.
I mean, we're not like a criminal court where one person can hang the jury. If one objectionable juror is out against you, as you say they were, then they'll just vote differently from everybody else, won't they?
Well, they can now. I think with the new law under punitive damages, there has to be a unanimous verdict. One juror can.
But not as to everything else.
Not as to everything else, that's true. That's true.
I thought you stated previously that your client was awarded punitive damages.
As to the settling defendant and as to judgment proof, nurses aide, Jerry Tristan.
So this juror that you had concerns about or have concerns about was able to find with the other 11 that punitive damages, in fact, should have been awarded in this case.
That juror did vote with the majority of the rest of the panel. That's true.
So where's the harm?
The harm is in having to use one of our strikes on an objectionable juror. And the harm occurs when, and that's under the case law,
I understand that case law, and I appreciate the concern that each side have a fair trial and a just verdict be rendered. But it seems to me that had this defendant been hit with a greater number, you may not be here. And I'm trying to balance that issue with the concern that I have that perhaps this juror may have been struck. I should have been struck, along with the issue that I have that the trial court should have discretion in making that determination.
Well, in this case, the non-settling defendant wasn't hit with any punitive damages. He did not get a judgment of any significant sum of money against the non-settling defendant, and the punitive damages were against the settling defendant and were not collectible. So in this case, we really didn't win, not against the non-settling defendant.
But the settling defendant participated in the trial.
They did. We had a high level.
Right. That's my question. Are there any circumstances under which we could look at the jury's verdict and look at harmful error in these challenge cases? I mean, it seems to me it might have been one thing if this jury said, well, you know, they may be liable, but I'm just absolutely not going to award more than $300,000. That would be one thing, perhaps. But even then, should we look at what the juror actually did?
I don't believe so, and I don't believe that it would be a significant problem. You just don't see if somebody wins, if we've gotten, in this case, if we've gotten a significant sum of money against a non-settling defendant, we wouldn't be here either. And there are very few cases, I think, I know only one where a prevailing party has appealed, but I'm out of time, Your Honor. But I would like one. There are several things. I guess I could address them in a follow-up.
Post-submission, if you would like. And that concludes this argument and all arguments for today. And the clerk will now adjourn the court. Thank you.